gives the impression that we are conspirators in a worldwide conspiracy, and that we dress in monkish robes and that we assassinate people. Not that I've got anything but the harsh respect for monks, but we're not that way.
That's Andrew Sohn. He's spokesperson for a Roman Catholic group called Opus Dei, talking about how his group has been misrepresented by Dan Brown's best-selling novel, The Da Vinci Code. We're going to be talking about this Roman Catholic group, Opus Dei. How secretive is this group? What's its real history? Dan Brown makes a lot of hay with Opus Dei in his novel. Is what Dan Brown says about Opus Dei true? We'll find that out here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back for another week. It's Monday, the 21st of March, and we're kicking off a busy Monday here on the program. Dr. James Hitchcock will be our guest here in the first 25 minutes to talk about Opus Dei. If you read the novel, The Da Vinci Code, and you're curious how much fact there is in the fiction, stay tuned for the first 25 minutes there. We'll also talk about the limits of science with Dr. Kurt Marquardt in the second half hour of the program. He's from Concordia Seminary and Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. There in the second hour of the program, a series of updates on life issues. Of course, top of mind and of top priorities. An update on Terry Schindler's Schiavo. Rita Marker, Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, will join us for that update. That'll be followed by a conversation with Patty Skane of Missouri Right to Life. There is human cloning legislation in Missouri, and we need to talk about it. We will there in the middle of the second hour. And then, to round things off in that second hour, Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life will be our guest. There's human cloning legislation in Illinois. In fact, it's about funding human cloning to the tune of $1 billion. It's not taxpayer money. It is bond money to be paid from elective surgery and plastic surgery. That you'll pay a little bit more if you're going to get your Botox, and it will go to pay off the bonds, $1 billion in the state of Illinois to fund human cloning research. We'll find out what's becoming of that bill in the second hour of the program. Then in hour three, Robert Schuller of the Hour of Power, I'm talking about Senior Robert Schuller this time, will be reviewing his sermon in our weekly sermon review. This is one you're going to have to listen very carefully to. Number one, it's short and sweet, so you'll have to listen carefully in that respect. Robert Schuller is going to preach the cross. To what end is a question. I've got a question for you at the end of that sermon review. We've done these for months now, probably the better part of a year, reviewing more or less weekly a sermon from a prominent preacher or some that are not so prominent. The whole goal of these sermon reviews is not to talk about bad preachers, but bad preaching. And by way of looking for Jesus and looking for the cross and looking for the message of the cross, the forgiveness of sins that Christ won there with his death and his resurrection. So when we get to the end of the Schuller sermon, I want to know from you, did he do it? He's going to preach the cross. Did he preach the gospel, the good news of the cross? That'll be the question for you in the third hour of Issues, Etc. Let you join the sermon review. Dr. James Hitchcock is our guest. He's professor of history at St. Louis University and a regular here on Issues, Etc. He joins us to talk about Opus Dei. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back.
Thank you. Always glad to be here.
How secretive, really, is this group, Opus Dei?
Well, it's a claim that pursues them all the time. First of all, a little background. It's a Spanish organization originally founded, I believe, in the 1930s. Opus Dei means the work of God, and it's a primarily lay group, but with clerical leadership. The secretive idea, I think, stems from this, that Opus Dei has a notion that you don't go out and proclaim yourself publicly as necessarily a member of Opus Dei, or even for that member purpose necessarily a Catholic, but you work quietly among your co-workers in your community and so on to promote the values of the gospel, not denying your affiliation, but not broadcasting it either. So I think that's kind of the source of this notion that they're very secretive.
Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, and it's going to be a movie here. Ron Howard will direct in collusion with, I believe, Tom Hanks in some capacity coming up. It's supposed to be another blockbuster movie, but The Da Vinci Code book makes a lot of hay with Opus Dei. Is it really true that what Dan Brown supposes, that this is a secretive group that spans all the way back to the very earliest times of the church and has covered up the true nature of Christianity?
No. Pretty much, I would guess, about 90% of what's in Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code is fiction, including that. He proposes, you know, this underground conspiracy of various secret groups going all the way back, as you say, to early times. But the history of Opus Dei is well defined, well studied, and it goes back, as I say, it's either the 30s or the 40s, I forget which, in Spain. And in fact, the Opus Dei people think of themselves as representing something quite new, in the sense that it is predominantly lay, and in the sense that the members of Opus Dei tend to be professionals in one way or another. Again, they sort of think of themselves as working out in the world in various capacities, and in that sense, almost no link to any of the religious orders and that kind of thing that had gone before.
I was looking into this myself very briefly before the program, and it sounds as though Opus Dei is what I would put in Lutheran parlance, a group that focuses upon people living out their Christian lives in their individual vocations.
Yes, I think that's that's exactly what it is. They think of themselves, as I say again, as responding to modern conditions. It originated in Spain during the Franco era, and at that time the Franco government was, of course, friendly to the Catholic Church, but the idea of Opus Dei is that you live in a modern society which is predominantly secular, so, you know, you don't rely on, in a certain sense, any official support. The culture around you may not be friendly, so you kind of work in an individual way you know, there's a secretive element in the sense that, you know, they might say, well, you know, maybe one of our people can work his way up and become, you know, an influential member of a corporation, let's say, and then he can influence the corporation to act in accordance with Christian values. That would be the kind of thing that they would talk about.
Is there any affiliation between Opus Dei and the papacy, in particular Pope John Paul II?
Well, there's obviously, of course, an affiliation in the sense that it's an approved Catholic group, and John Paul has indeed shown them considerable favor. It's a bit of a technical point, but some years back he established what was called a personal prelature, that is to say, they are under the authority of a bishop in Rome who is at the head of the whole Opus Dei network. And they're like religious orders then in that sense, and that means they're quasi-independent of the local bishop, not completely, but at least up to a point. John Paul is very big on what he calls the movements, which is newer groups arising, again, many of them thinking of themselves as being very modern, as not following traditional methods, and I think he quite clearly sees Opus Dei as one of those.
So how did this group, Opus Dei, gain the reputation of being not only super secretive, but in fact not what it appears to be on the surface, a centuries-long conspiracy of some sort, Dan Brown says, to cover up the genuine nature of Christianity?
Well, as far as I know, I could be mistaken, Dan Brown is the first person who has claimed that Opus Dei has had an underground existence for many centuries. They have a lot of critics, and including Catholics, and I think Opus Dei has been sometimes unnecessarily closed mouth. You know, they tend to sort of deflect questions, and they don't put out standard information about how many members they have and who belongs to it and all the rest of it, as religious orders do, for example. The other thing for which they have been often criticized is that they are fairly, in some respects, very modern, but they also follow a fairly traditional, rather strict ascetical practice. They put a lot of emphasis on fasting and praying and disciplining of yourself and something not in harmony with what a lot of people today think of as modern religion.
They have been referred to as Catholic fundamentalists. Is it a fitting title?
Well, in a certain respect, it depends, of course, on what you mean by a fundamentalist. The term fundamentalist, which, of course, as you know, originates in Protestant circles, is now used in Catholic circles basically to mean anyone who accepts all the teachings of the Church. So in that sense, like John Paul II is a fundamentalist, and certainly in that sense you would say they are. Now, in terms, for example, of the Protestant fundamentalist dispute, let's say, over the literal inerrancy of the Bible, I don't think Opus Dei is particularly involved in that.
So, in other words, when we hear a term like Catholic fundamentalists within the Catholic pale, that usually means the true believers.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way that, if you say, yeah, I believe all the teachings of the Church, all the disputed points of morality, etc., then you become a fundamentalist.
Some have said that Opus Dei has cultic qualities. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, again, it's a matter of what you mean by that. They are a hard sell sometimes, I think, where I've known of cases where they find someone whom they think is a good prospect and they go after them, not using what I would consider, unfair tactics or anything of that kind. And the cult idea, of course, usually involves the idea of psychological brainwashing, maybe even holding people against their wills. There's no evidence of that in Opus Dei. They basically follow methods which I think would have been followed by most Catholic religious orders up until about 40, 50 years ago. One difference I'd say between a cult and this kind of thing is that cults apparently are very reluctant to let people go. Traditionally, religious orders were fairly quick to throw them out, which was a difference. And I suspect the same is true with Opus Dei. If they don't think you're suitable, you're out. The other cult thing that comes into it, and it ties into the secrecy, and again, I think it's a thing they shouldn't do. They have been known to run programs without telling everybody who they are. They will announce a lecture series, or they will announce some spiritual retreats and exercises, and even sometimes social events, and then it will turn out later it's being organized by Opus Dei. That seems to me to be kind of unnecessary secretiveness, probably caused by the fact that they know that there are some people who react automatically in a negative way if they hear Opus Dei.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on this Roman Catholic group called Opus Dei, call now 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. James Hitchcock is our guest at 4:30, coming up in about 10 minutes or so. We'll be talking to Dr. Kurt Marquardt about the limits of science, and that'll round off the first hour of Issues, Etc. today. As a historian, what do you make, generally speaking, of the conspiracy theories that seem to be so much of kind of the pop view of Roman Catholicism? It's so big, it's so long-lived, it's got to involve some kind of a conspiracy.
Right. Well, for one thing, of course, you're dealing here, because it has been around for so long and it involves so many millions and millions of people, it's pretty tough to have a conspiracy on that scale. A conspiracy to be successful has to be, I think, fairly small and fairly contained. The other thing about conspiracies is that it's very difficult, I think, to, in a certain sense, keep secrets. that, you know, sooner or later things seem to leak out. You know, there's a government plan and suddenly the document gets leaked, or in the case of people like Opus Dei, there are a certain number of disgruntled ex-members who go public, and what they usually complain about is they say, well, you know, I was given a very negative kind of approach to spirituality and so on. They don't say, oh, there was a plot to take over the world. So I think the whole, again, of course, it also depends on what you mean by a conspiracy. I mean, anytime two people get together to discuss something and they wish to achieve a certain goal, well, you can say it's a conspiracy, you know. You can say, well, let's write a letter to the newspaper and try to influence people's thinking this way or the other. Well, you know, you can call that a conspiracy if you want.
Are they a religious order in any sense?
Not in a technical sense. I'm not quite sure about this in a technical sense. There is something in the Catholic Church which is called lay institutes, which are somewhat like religious orders. I believe that technically they are not, but I don't quite know what they are. They're like religious orders in the sense that people join them, and some of the people, not all of them, in Opus Dei, make a lifetime commitment. They in effect take lifetime vows like people in religious orders. They vow themselves to celibacy. They vow themselves to obedience to their superiors. There's another category. Those are the ones who usually live in Opus Dei houses. They actually have houses of their own, you could say, almost in a sense like monasteries, except people go out into the world. Then they have another category of members who I think is probably more numerous, who make temporary commitments, maybe year to year, and they continue to live in the world. Many of them are married, have children, and that theirs is not a permanent commitment.
Let's go to the phones. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Up first, Harold from St. Charles. Harold, welcome.
Yeah, Dr. Hitchcock, I enjoy you being on KFUO so very much. My question is, and maybe it's an obvious answer to it, is that what's the view of Opus Dei toward those seemingly very, very liberal people in the church who just seem to go against traditionalist teachings that were established down through the years? And what's their view toward those people? Some of these, some liberal Roman Catholics are not much different than some of the very liberal Protestants. And one last thing. I assume that your dear wife, that also appears on this program, was her father, a Dr. Hole, who taught church history at St. Louis University years ago.
Why don't you take the personal question first there, Dr. Hitchcock?
No, my wife, I don't remember such a fellow. My wife's father was a school superintendent in western Kansas. As to Opus Dei, yes, well, they are certainly defenders of orthodoxy. We talked a little bit ago about that phrase, fundamentalist, and that's one reason, again, most liberal Catholics, to the degree they know anything about Opus Dei, regard it with some degree of animosity or suspicion. They are thought of as the Pope's shock troops, for example. But I would also say this, Opus Dei is, they fit into the church structure. So, for example, Opus Dei will not, almost never get involved in any kind of public conflict with a bishop, a priest, even if they think that what the bishop or the priest is doing is improper, because they're very careful to observe the correct structure and procedures of the church. And in fact, I've known people who were pretty militant, let's say, in their defense of church teaching, who decided to get out of Opus Dei because they were being told, now don't be so aggressive, don't be so outspoken, you know, you're making enemies. And so Opus Dei is certainly very orthodox, but they're not, in that sense, they're not really on the front lines.
Someone might say at this point, a listener who's maybe read Dan Brown's novel, they say, look, all that you say may just, in fact, just be the party line about Opus Dei, if they were, in fact, this long-lived conspiracy within the Roman Church to cover up the true nature of Christendom. That's exactly how you'd expect them to present themselves, as an innocuous group.
Well, that's quite true, and I don't think you can, you know, you can't disprove something like that. If someone says James Hitchcock in 1961, you know, robbed a bank, how can I prove that I didn't? it would be a very difficult thing. I think what you'd have to say is the evidence is just isn't there. You know, Dan Brown plays a fast game. If he's pressed, he says, well, after all, this is a work of fiction. But then in sort of vague terms, he talks about everything in here is based on fact. Well, if Dan Brown had the historical evidence that would prove these various claims, he would have been far better off to have written a work of history or a work of journalism, which would not have, you know, muddied up the waters. He would have said, look, I found these documents. They prove that Opus Dei goes back and that they're involved in this conspiracy. The fact that he chooses to put in a fictional form is, I think, pretty indicative of the fact that he doesn't have the evidence.
And then generally speaking, how would you evaluate the other claims of history that are made, even in the fictionalized form, in Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code?
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start. The whole business about the search for the Grail and the hiding places of the Grail and of course, the role of Mary Magdalene in the life of Jesus, I mean, all of it is really fictional for the most part. I mean, he's starting point of certain facts, which he then just embroiders, or I wouldn't even say embroiders, but makes use of in any way he possibly wants. We, as you know, we have practically no knowledge of Jesus except what is to be found in the Gospels. And Dan Brown starts off, therefore, with Jesus and then says, but the Gospels falsified his life and his ministry. Well, if that's true, then we have to say we know nothing about Jesus, because the Gospels are, in fact, our only source of information. Now, he makes reference, of course, to the so-called Gnostic Gospels, but they are actually later than the New Testament itself, and if you doubt the historicity of the New Testament, you have to doubt the historicity of the Gnostic Gospels even more.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University, and a regular guest here on the program. Dr. Hitchcock, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
We've been talking about this group called Opus Dei. Of course, it figures into this vast jigsaw puzzle of Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code. Just notice here at the end of this conversation how a novel like that can make itself essentially bulletproof. First of all, you base your conspiracy on negatives that cannot be proven as a matter of philosophical principle, and then you call into question the primary historical documents. You substitute others that really, in a genuine sense, are no more reliable if the historical documents aren't reliable. And pretty soon, you're free to make it up as you go along. And if the constraints of your novel are a page-turner and a cloak-and-dagger conspiracy that people are apt to want to at least suspend their disbelief and believe in while they're reading your book, well, you've got a bestseller on your hands. Not necessarily having anything to do with the truth, however. When we come back from this break, Dr. Kurt Marquardt will join us. We'll talk about the limits of science. He's from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
One of the most interesting and influential theologians and teachers of the 20th century is also one of the most intriguing preachers of the 20th century. Dr. Norman Nagel is a regular guest on Issues, Etc., and our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is the Selected Sermons of Norman Nagel, but this book is not about Dr. Nagel. It is, like all of his sermons, about Christ and Him crucified. This selection of over 50 sermons over a lifetime of preaching is $24.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. There you'll find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, selected sermons of Norman Nagel.
A celebration of life takes place this month in the country of Iran. This Global Minute highlights Iran so you can pray for Christ's love to spread there. Nowruz is the oldest tradition of Iran, and the celebration starts on the first day of spring. Originally, Nowruz was meant to celebrate love between the Creator and the creation. Here's what people believe. The spirits of dead relatives return each year around this time so they can establish close family bonds. Even though Nowruz is widely observed in Iran, it's not an Islamic holiday and is also celebrated by Jewish, Armenian, and Turkish families living there. Rituals are supposed to convey a strong sense of belonging to each other. Pray Christians in Iran will speak clearly about Christ's love to people celebrating Nowruz. Pray for Iran and then log on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org so you can learn about other people needing prayer. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. What makes you angry on Monday? On Monday of Holy Week, Jesus really got ticked off. The day before, Palm Sunday, Jesus had entered Jerusalem to wild acclaim. "Hosanna to the Son of David," the crowds had yelled. On Monday of Holy Week, he entered the temple area, a big complex with several courtyards dominated by the temple building. One of those courtyards was for non-Jews, the Gentiles. Intended to be their place to approach God, they had been crowded out by people changing foreign currency into the Jewish money needed for sacrifices. When Jesus saw that, he went ballistic. He overturned their tables and benches and quoted Isaiah 56, verse 7, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations." And then added this zinger from Jeremiah 7:11, "But you are making it a den of robbers." Jesus knew he was destined to die to pay the penalty of sin so that all people could know the forgiving love of God. Let the routine business of the church get in the way of people worshiping God? No way! And Jesus showed the anger of God. You have anger energy. Don't use it to the harm of others. Direct it toward a godly spiritual purpose. Clear away anything that gets in the way of meditation and worship this Holy Week.
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the next 25 minutes, we're going to be talking with Dr. Kurt Marquardt about the limits of science. And then in the second hour, Rita Marker joins us for an update on Terry Schindler's Shivo. That is of big importance. Also, some other important stories on the pro-life front will follow that. Patty Skane of Missouri Right to Life will join us about human cloning legislation in Missouri. Then Bill Beckman of Illinois Right to Life on human cloning legislation in Illinois. Open Lines is the third hour of the program. We'll be looking at a very brief sermon from Dr. Robert Schuller of The Hour of Power. And my question for you is, he will mention the cross. Does he preach the gospel? Does he preach the cross as good news, what Christ has done for you? That'll be the question I want your answer to in the third hour of the program. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Kurt Marquardt is Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in this book called Reading God's World. His chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling Science. Dr. Marquardt, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
How do you respond to kind of the common notion now that what science can't see, observe, measure, verify experimentally doesn't exist. It science sets the limits of human knowledge in a real sense.
Well, that in itself would be a kind of materialist view, but science, physics itself has transcended that. You have today, physics has long gone beyond the directly observable. Quarks and quanta and things like that are not really observable.
So in other words, even the frontiers of science as we have them now are dealing with things that cannot be, they can be formulated as mathematical formulae.
Yes.
But they cannot be observed, measured, yeah, or any
of those. Some of them, they are beyond direct observation, yes.
What's the difference between science and scientism?
Well, science is a perfectly honorable and right pursuit, namely to find out what this universe is like. Whereas scientism is making a religion out of science and making it some kind of an absolute ideology.
Describe that scientism in a little more detail, if you would. How does it become religion?
Well, my own view is that in the 19th century particularly, this particular view of science became a religion substitute for many of the educated people in Europe, the intelligentsia. So they replaced the lost certainties of Christian dogma with this new science, which was supposed to be a certain belief system. But that was a 19th century superstition. Now we know that science is basically is to be held with a light hand because it rests on empirical evidence. That is, it rests on probability. It does not rest on certainty.
Now, you have written this, and I'd like you to explain it, if you would, Dr. Marquardt. This comes at the end of your chapter, but I think it's very telling. You say, it is my own conviction that the most interesting scientific/philosophical problem today is that of the source of prodigious amount of information represented by biological organisms. What in the world do you mean?
Well, what I mean is this, that especially since 1963, it's been known that the hereditary mechanism, DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is really a vast information system. And information theory tells us that information does not arise from randomness, but is destroyed by randomness. And therefore, life could not have originated at random. And this is the great strength of today's intelligent design movement, which has even converted the British atheist, Anthony Flew, who at the age of 81 finally gave up his atheism.
He's at the very least become a deist.
Yes.
But certainly not a Christian.
No, although it's interesting that he says that there is more evidence for the resurrection than for any other so-called religious miracle. So I hope he's on the way.
You also write extensively in your chapter about Sir Karl Popper.
Yes.
Who, kind of on the outs with everybody, science, the Marxists, whoever else he happened to run into. Tell us about Karl Popper and his ideas about science.
Well, Karl Popper has been considered the greatest philosopher of the 20th century. When he died, I was surprised to find out that he had been an advisor to Margaret Thatcher and her government in England. The Soviets hated him because he didn't just concentrate on science, but he also defended human freedom and strongly attacked Marxism and other captive systems like that. But Popper started out in the Jewish community in Vienna, I believe, in Austria, fled Hitler's tyranny, and I think ended up in New Zealand and then ended up in London at the University of London. But he was a very, very great thinker, and he specialized in philosophy of science.
Now, he advocated a certain approach to science that has run against the grain of almost everything nowadays. What was his view of science?
Well, actually, his view is widely accepted still. Namely, he resisted the idea that science is merely instrumentalism, that it's just a way of controlling nature, but it doesn't tell us anything objective. And Popper insisted that science, that truly great scientists have always been interested in finding out what the universe is like. And Einstein was not just interested in manipulation, he was interested in finding out what the cosmos is really like.
But for a while, you write, Einstein himself bought into the instrumentalist view that science can do nothing more than simply describe our observations, but we don't know what real really is. Did Einstein ever change his mind?
Apparently he did. Yeah, he regretted the subjectivism of his earlier view. He had long correspondence with Popper on that very subject, and Popper quotes him.
There are two events that take place at or near the Reformation. One of them is tied directly to the Reformation, that being a scriptural distinction being sharpened between the right and the left-hand kingdoms,
yeah.
The distinction between law and gospel. I want you to speak about that, if you would, and how it impacts science as a vocation.
Well, one of the great Reformation discoveries was the rediscovery of the dignity of lay people's work. For example, farmers, soldiers, office workers, factory workers, they used to be considered unspiritual. And the only spiritual worthy work was to be a monk or a nun. That nonsense was swept away by the Reformation, which restored the dignity of every Christian's daily calling. And that includes science. So that's the enormous significance there.
Now, the other one is the so-called Copernican Revolution.
Yes.
A change in the way that, at the very least, the solar system we inhabit was viewed. And you say that, unlike their counterparts in the Reformation, the Lutherans had no problem with the Copernican Revolution. Tell us about it.
Well, that's an interesting thing. The Vatican condemned Copernicanism, but not for any biblical reasons, but basically because they were hanging on to old Greek philosophy. Whereas the Reformed were biblical fundamentalists or biblicists, literalists in a bad sense, and they thought that was unbiblical. But the Lutherans, it was at Lutheran universities that Copernicanism flourished in the 16th century.
And why is that?
Because of the distinction of law and gospel and the distinction of the two kingdoms, that science has a perfect right to formulate on the basis of scientific evidence the nature of the universe.
And back to Karl Popper, you talk about how he wants to speak of three worlds.
Yes.
And how, and therefore the limits of science, and as you say, it gets science and theology minding their own business, really, in a lot of ways. World one, what is it, what are these three worlds that Popper talks about?
Well, for him, world one is the subjective world of some individual human being. World two world one is the material world. World two is a subjective world. And world three is the cultural world. And the reason I like that is there are some of these postmodernists floating around that no scientist can respect. But they hold that all convictions are really basically subjective. But Popper very neatly points out that when an idea has come into the public view, then other people can draw conclusions from it which never occurred to the original inventor of the idea. So that means that the cultural, the world of ideas, has a certain objective existence, and that different minds can participate in it. So there's an objectivity to it. It's not just subjectivism. That, to me, is a great strength of Popper's suggestion there.
We're talking with Dr. Kurt Marquardt about the limits of science. He's Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored a chapter in the book called Reading God's World. The chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or comment as we talk about the limits of science, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I had my interest sparked by listening to a radio interview with a physicist, a quantum physicist, a proponent of what's now being called string theory. And so I bought the guy's book. It's called The Elegant Universe. I'm about three quarters of the way through this, and it's kind of rough going, Dr. Marquardt, because
yes.
It involves a lot of very abstract thinking. I am no mathematician. He's trying to take very complicated mathematical postulates about the nature of the universe, great and small, and put them in lay terms. So I am slugging through this book.
Yes, it's quite an adventure.
One of the things that I find fascinating about this is as the smaller the things that are observed by science, the more problems they run into with trying to square it with all of the accepted theories about how the physical world ought to work.
Yeah.
Now, here is a quote that you have in your chapter, and I want you to explain the significance of this. This is a quote from P.W. Atkins. Science will be forced to admit defeat if it has to stop at a seed of any size. That is, the severity of the criterion that science sets apart for itself. If we are to be honest, then we have to accept that science will be able to claim complete success only if it achieves what many might think impossible, accounting for the emergence of everything from absolutely nothing. Not almost nothing, not a subatomic dust-like speck, but absolutely nothing, nothing at all, not even empty space. Why do you quote Atkins at this point?
Because it strikes me as a good example of an absolutism that really makes science impossible. They want an absolute dogmatism, and that is simply not what science is. Science is a good practical discipline showing, on the basis of common sense and observation, what this cosmos really is like.
So are we dealing with two diametrically opposed worldviews, if we put science in the best possible light, not scientism, but science as a sacred calling, and the so-called Christian worldview?
Well, there really is no, contrary to what is being written today, there is really no relation between theology and science, because they follow entirely different methods and entirely different authorities and subject matter. But since we are made to inhabit this physical universe, science is a perfectly legitimate, honorable subject, also for Christians, and there's nothing wrong with it, as long as it's not made into some absolute dogmatism and religion. And this is, again, the greatness of Popper. He refuses to regard it as this dogmatic ideology, which is a 19th century superstition.
So let's deal with a few particulars, realms of science. In the area of biology, Darwinism, or something close to Darwinism, has held sway for 100 years.
Yes.
Is it science?
Strictly speaking, the Darwinian thing deals with past events, and therefore it's more of the, more history than science, and history is notoriously unscientific. So genuine science can be, scientific theories can be tested in the laboratory or mathematically in some concrete way. But to say that something happened 10 million years ago is not really testable.
Does Darwinian thought suffer from the same, what you call dogmatic absolutism? That is, where the physicist might say, we've got to probe smaller and smaller until we find the smallest thing, and we're not going to really be honest unless we find out that it's nothing at all. The Darwinist theory nowadays says we've got to go back until we find not the origin of life, but chaos itself.
Yes, and the dogmatic Darwinians today insist that that you can't introduce supernatural causes, such as a great mind. But the interesting thing is that Darwinism has today fallen into conflict with genuine science, namely information theory, because information theory shows that randomness does not create but destroys information, as you can easily illustrate with misspellings of various kinds.
Now, on this whole, where does information then fall? Because this is key to understanding your point. Some people might say, look, information is just energy and matter organizing itself in some way.
Right. However, one of the great founders of information theory, Norbert Wiener, another escapee from Hitler's terror, wrote in 1948 in his book on cybernetics that information is information and not matter or energy. So it's a different category, different kettle of fish altogether. And matter and energy do not explain information. Because if you ever built a castle on the sand at the beach, the next wave did not improve it. And the great British astronomer, Sir Fred Hoyle, who used to be an atheist, no longer is, but he writes that to expect information content of this kind to arise, he says you may as well think that a tornado striking a junkyard will produce a 747 jumbo jet. It's simply not in the cards.
Let's talk then in the last few minutes about intelligent design. You mentioned it before. William Dembski is mentioned in your chapter as well. He's been a guest on the program as well as other advocates of intelligent design. Is this friend or foe, intelligent design, to the Christian theology?
Pardon me. Well, it really has nothing to do with Christian theology, and that is its strength. The enemies of intelligent design have tried to portray it as just another way in which the creationists are trying to smuggle themselves into schools. But intelligent design does not rest, like creationism, does not rest on Genesis. It's not dealing with scripture at all. It's a purely scientific notion that information is not a measure of randomness, but information is a measure of improbability. And the randomness destroys information. Therefore, if life is information, it cannot have arisen at random. That's a purely scientific argument.
Now, some will fault intelligent design, saying, look, for exactly the same reason others fault it. Christians might fault it for saying, look, it just doesn't go far enough. Why not, if you're going to talk about intelligent design, why not talk about the designer?
Well, but on what basis would one do that? Intelligent design can only tell us, and that's basically what St. Paul writes in Romans 1, that it's possible from an observation of nature to come to the conclusion that there must be a creator. And that's all that intelligent design does. There must be some sort of creator, but what he is like, we can't learn from nature. Nature is, as it were, full of the footprints of God, but you don't know anybody from footprints.
Is the fault, given the limited nature of that, what theologians would call natural revelation that Paul talks about there in Romans 1,
yeah.
This is something I found our listeners may be confused on, too. Is the fault with the revelation itself, or with our reading of natural revelation? In other words, did God leave false footprints that look like old Earth, that look like fossil record going back hundreds of millions of years, that look like evolution, or are we just misreading an accurate account?
Yes, it's basically human misreading. But then again, there are so many issues involved, and it's not easy to determine the exact facts. But the interesting thing is that when Mount St. Helens exploded there some years ago, the deposits later would have been aged at millions of years, when actually they happened in a few hours.
How would you then evaluate, given what you said about intelligent design, how would you evaluate the attempts that are older than ID as attempts to mix, conflate science, or at least Darwinian science, and the biblical account, scientific creationism, it's sometimes called?
Well, I criticize it in that article, too, that if you try to mix up some elements of science and elements of theology, your whole thing will be out of date within a few years anyway, because science is constantly advancing. And the Bible does not give us the specific nature of the universe. We have to learn that from science. So it's mixing two things that don't really belong together.
So is this exactly what happened there at the time of the Reformation while the Copernican Revolution is going on? The reformers on the Lutheran side look at Copernicus's new model for the solar system and said, wow, since the Bible is not a book describing the nature of the physical universe per se, this seems to jive nicely with what we observe and with what Scripture teaches.
Yes, and Scripture, like the language of preaching, uses ordinary language. So sunset, sunrise, and even the most sophisticated physicist, when he talks to his wife about the sunset, he doesn't say, look how beautifully the earth is turning.
Finally, and very briefly, Dr. Marquardt, what about the is and the ought of science? Science can tell us what is. Can it tell us what ought to be or what we ought to do?
No, it can't, because it can merely tell us the physical constitution of the universe. So moral reasoning has to come from another source.
What happens when someone tries to derive moral reasoning from science alone?
Well, then finally, anything becomes permissible, whatever we can do, because science is basically methodology. And we can devise all sorts of ways of depriving somebody of a life. But whether the person ought to be deprived of his life, science cannot determine. That rests on totally different grounds. And therefore, science has to be subject to a strong system of morality.
Dr. Kurt Marquardt is Associate Professor of Systematic Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's authored this chapter in the book Reading God's World. His chapter is titled Sacred Cow or Sacred Calling. Dr. Marquardt, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
As I mentioned, Dr. Marquardt teaches at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Every summer, Concordia Theological Seminary there in Fort Wayne holds a two-week residential program for high school-aged men. They will go, you know, they've been sitting in the high school classroom learning their science. Maybe if they've gone to a parochial school, they've learned a little bit of their Bible as well. How do you sort these things out, especially if you are headed toward the pulpit and the pastoral ministry? Do you say, I'm a pastor and I know nothing about these things, therefore I'm not going to comment? I'm going to leave those big questions alone? Well, they'll get part of the answer. At Christ Academy 2005, a two-week residential program for high school-aged men at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. If you know of a young man, or if you are a young man interested in the pastoral ministry, high school-aged, call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155, or go to our website, issuesetc.org. When you scroll down, you'll see the logo for Christ Academy 2005 and a link right next to it where you can get more information on this two-week residential program on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, issuesetc.org. Look for the Christ Academy 2005 logo. When we come back, we're going to be hearing some sound bites and getting an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. Rita Marker of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide will be our guest. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.